Chapter 4, Expanded Differential.
So, you know, I talk about the three things that I always forget. You know, I always remember ischemia, but I always forget electrolyte abnormalities. I forget drug overdoses as a cause of bradycardia that requires specific therapy. Let's flesh that out some more and have Stuart tell us about those three, but also add a couple more that I think are important. Go.
Well, you know, Mel, I think it's really helpful to talk about bradycardia in the scenarios in which it occurs. Let's talk about some bradycardia plus scenarios. Let's talk about bradycardia plus chest pain, shortness of breath, anginal equivalent, that sort of patient. You think that they might be having myocardial ischemia that's going along with their bradycardia. So that's something, let's talk about that first. You know, this is really actually fascinating. When you're ischemic, you can actually get tachycardic or bradycardic. But usually you get tachycardic. So for example, if I cut off some of the supply to my heart, I'm going to get less blood. It's going to make my heart less effective. The cardiac output will not be as big because the stroke volume will be smaller. The heart will be weaker. And so generally speaking, tachycardia is the result of ischemia because the heart is trying to compensate by going faster for the fact that its stroke volume is lower. And so it's quite an interesting scenario, isn't it, when you have both ischemia and bradycardia, because it's not the usual sequence. And that's what makes us think about things like conduction delays and special types of heart attacks that can actually screw with the conduction system. And so that's sort of the interesting thing here. Just to reinforce that point, you know, nitroglycerin, a medicine that we all give all the time to patients with chest pain, right? And what is nitro supposed to do to the average person? Drops their pressure, increases their heart rate as a reflex tachycardia because you've dropped their pressure. But you probably noticed that a lot of the patients that are coming in stressed out, tachycardic, that you give nitro to for their chest pain, their heart rate goes down. And so that kind of drives home that point that it's really about how well you're perfusing the heart that determines in many cases what your heart rate is. So anyway, we're usually thinking when you've got bradycardia plus chest pain that you're in trouble, that you've got a serious type of acute coronary syndrome that can be really life-threatening. And traditionally, we divide those types of heart blocks by the types of heart attack and their territories. So for example, just to reinforce some of the things that you were talking about, Mel, when you have a big anterior MI, one that involves the left anterior descending artery, the big one, right? You tend to get death and dying of your conduction system. So you tend to get these more profound, more severe, more wide complex blocks. And as you also mentioned, you can try atropine for those, but it might not work because there's nothing for the atropine to work on and they really need a pacemaker. So that's the first thing. In contrast to that, inferior MIs, which are usually a smaller territory of the heart and usually are from an occlusion of the right coronary artery, they cause less severe blocks because they have to do with vagal irritation. The inferior part of the heart is innervated by the vagus nerve, the diaphragms, you get irritation of that sometimes. And so just because they have excessive vagal tone, they can be bradycardic and they're very sensitive to atropine. And so that's the traditional two categories, the anterior MIs and the inferior MIs. But you know what? In our case today, we had something a little bit different. Mm-hmm. We had what I would call a nasty inferior MI, or we had a severe right coronary syndrome. And it was just like the resident said at the end, they had a severe right coronary syndrome. And it turns out that when you occlude the very proximal part of the right coronary artery and you get one of these more severe inferior syndromes, often you do get death of your conduction system and you do get these anterior MI-like conduction delays. So basically, the anteriors are usually pretty bad, the inferiors are not bad, but remember, there's this special type of proximal RCA occlusion that you get when the inferior MIs act kind of like the anterior. So that's sort of the classic breakdown of the different types of MIs.
So let's be clear, ischemia, bradycardia plus chest pain, we went through that anatomy there, but it doesn't break any of our rules. We're going to try atropine, that's fine. It may not work. If it's wide complex, we're going to try transcutaneous pacemaking. And if all of that's failing, then we're going to try epinephrine, we're going to try dopamine. So it doesn't break any of our rules, but it makes a bit more fleshed out idea of how this stuff works.
Okay, the next scenario that we find ourselves in is when we have a combination of bradycardia and a syncopal episode, or maybe lightheadedness. The combination of syncope or lightheadedness together with bradycardia. And the reason why this is so interesting is usually when we're thinking about syncope, someone sitting in front of us and they actually lost consciousness, we're actually worried about tachydysrhythmias, like ventricular tachycardia. That's what we're always obsessed about. Could this person have had an episode of VTach, right? But in the case of bradycardias and syncope, we also do have a small amount of things to worry about. And the main one is third degree heart block, or the so-called Stokes-Adam attacks. So when someone is walking along and minding their own business and they have a conduction problem that's transient in their heart, maybe they've had previous MIs, they've had cardiomyopathy, they have a diseased heart, they could actually all of a sudden go into one of these severe types of blocks and hit the ground. It might make them lightheaded at times. And so we are basically looking for this when we see someone that's had either syncope or lightheadedness. The one thing that's a little bit fascinating is that sometimes when you actually see these patients, they're tachycardic with a sinus tachycardia.
Hmm.
Can you think of why that might be?
The Stokes-Adams or the sick sinus syndrome?
Sick sinus syndrome.
Yes, I can.
You just said the answer, which is that sometimes patients with sick sinus syndrome, remember, they call it the tachy Brady syndrome. And sometimes their malfunctioning SA node is firing too much and sometimes not enough. And that's a very typical thing for the sinus to do as it's dying in its last death grasp. It usually is malfunctioning in both ways. And so sometimes you'll see a patient who had a syncopal episode from a third degree heart block, but when you see them, they're in one of their tachy phases. And so just because a patient's tachycardic doesn't mean that that sinus isn't defective and doesn't mean that they might possibly need a pacemaker.
It's kind of fun to watch them on the monitor. If you can catch this in the emergency department, they go 160, 170, 180, 30. It can be a care that fast, although often it's really hard to diagnose. They need an outpatient Holter. So you told us about bradycardia plus chest pain, and you just told us about bradycardia plus syncope, and I talked about bradycardia plus drugs or medicines. Tell us about those. You've got a few things to add there.
So in terms of drugs, we've talked about the Brady Bunch. The Brady Bunch, just to repeat them again, digoxin, beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, and clonidine. And these are all things that can cause you to have syncope because the rate is very slow. And they definitely can be not just overdoses, but people that are taking too much of their meds, make an adjustment in their medications that wasn't called for, that type of thing. And so you have to keep a broad mind about these. And they're each distinguishable by several clinical features, and they have different treatments. So just very, very quickly, digoxin is very interesting because in addition to the bradycardia, you often get a lot of irritability of both the atrium and the ventricle. So in addition to bradycardia, which can take many different forms, you often see VTAC intermittently in there and PVCs, and atrial fibrillation and atrial flutter thrown in there. And so it's that combination of an excited atrium and an excited ventricle with all that ectopy together with a severe block through the AV node and a resultant slow rate that really does make digoxin very unique among these Brady Bunch. Beta blockers and calcium blockers, they are very similar. Clinically, they can be differentiated on things like, you know, beta blockers make your sugar go low and calcium channel blockers make your sugar go high. I mean, there's other clues there, not to mention the bottle that the patient brings in with them. That might help. But they're both similar in that they both cause increasingly severe heart blocks. And it may be difficult to distinguish them on EKG, one from the other. And as you probably know, the treatments can be very similar. They're both critically ill, and they both have a lot of similar treatments in terms of glucagon and calcium and intralipid and even ECMO, if nothing else is working, because once these medicines wear off, the patient should be okay. Clonidine is also very unique because clonidine comes with a very big dose of altered mental status, independent of the slow heart rate. And so usually when I think of clonidine, I think of sort of an opioid type syndrome where it's kind of like an opioid overdose. They go slow, they become lethargic, their blood pressure goes down, their pupils become pinpoint, and that can be a very big distinguishing factor. And they don't tend to respond really well to naloxone. They might respond a little bit, but not as much as opioids. So those are the classic Brady Bunch meds that Dr. Norton and I always talk about. Another poisoning that can cause a serious bradycardia, although it can also present tachycardic, is organophosphates. And your big clue there is going to be, in addition to your pinpoint pupils, all the sludge syndrome. The salivation, lacrimation, urination, desquamation, defecation.
And bronchorrhea, which is not in that stupid mnemonic and the most important.
And then, of course, I should also mention that any medications that affect your electrolytes are also important. So, that, you know, we couldn't possibly go through all the medications that we're going to run into here, but anything that's going to raise your potassium, like any of the high blood pressure products that are out there that raise your potassium, could be causing bradycardia just by raising the potassium. So that's a critical thing.
I have dialysis and now I'm bradycardic. What am I doing?
Yeah, I'll never forget the patient that I had that I tell everyone about that came in basically asystolic and had no dialysis going on, but they needed dialysis and the family was aware that there was some renal issues going on. And you must never forget that bradycardia can be the presenting feature of hyperkalemia. And they don't necessarily have to have, as we've mentioned before, all those other classic hyperkalemia findings on the ECG. They don't necessarily have to have the peak T or the YQRS or the dropped P wave. But just bradycardia in and of itself, regardless of how it looks, it could be a blocked, could be a Mobitch 3, it doesn't Mobitch. Exist, a Mobitch 5. It doesn't matter. If it's slow, potassium's a possibility, wide, narrow. If it's just slow, that's enough. A couple of other issues, if a patient is unconscious and they're very bradycardic, you have to think about the Cushing's response. If the patient isn't talking to you and they're completely comatose and they're bradycardic and they're hypertensive, that might be an intracerebral bleed. That might be any one of the number of things that's actually brain pathology causing the problem. And you wouldn't want to miss that. So a CT scan, if nothing else is showing up, is going to be indicated in those cases. Now, two other causes of bradycardia are accidental hypothermia and endocrine causes, specifically myxedema coma. And these two are really interesting. They share something in common. Although all the other types of bradycardia that we were talking about, whether it's in a patient with ischemia or a patient with electrolyte problem, it really became critically important to get their rate up because they were dying of it. I mean, it's a really, really critical part of the management is get the rate up, however you can do it, right? But with these two, that is not the priority. So a patient might be very slow in their rate when they're hypothermic and they're 80 degrees. That's Fahrenheit, by the way, Mel.
Thank you.
So
you know. Okay, got it.
And same thing goes for myxedema coma. They might, again, be, you know, having no thyroid hormone in their body and they might be very cold. But you don't want to artificially just try to get that rate up because in both of those cases, if you start pacing and giving pressors and stuff, you can kill them because they have metabolisms that have been set on slow mode. So whether your temperature is really cold or your thyroid condition is very low, your body doesn't probably need as much heart rate. And so the treatment of those patients is the underlying problem, getting the temperature right, and the heart rate will adjust itself, for example, in the case of hypothermia, getting thyroid hormone replaced and getting the body going again in terms of its metabolism, that will get the heart rate up in those patients. And so those two can be kind of looked at differently.
So that's an important. So the primacy of rate, you've said it 1,000 times, get the rate up. But in this case, accidental hypothermia, myxedema coma, deal with the underlying disorder, the bradycardia will come along for the ride. That's very important.
Now, there's another point that I'll make about hypothermia, which is that they kind of have two phases electrocardiographically. When patients are not so cold, something, say, above 90 degrees Fahrenheit, they tend to shiver. And so one of the things you'll often see on their EKG is a shivering artifact. And so you'll see narrow QRSs at a slow rate and you'll see shivering. As they get really cold, they don't shiver anymore. And so that disappears and they get into the more severe dysrhythmias. It could be a sinus bradycardia or it could be just a really slow AFib, irregularly, but very slow. But either way, the shiver artifact will disappear as they get very cold. And what often does occur is our famous Osborne J wave, which is basically a notch in the end of QRS. And those things can actually help to pick apart between these different diagnoses, these different ECG findings.